loss of his uncluttered sunset view, Yancey fought an upwelling of anger. "Are you guys planning to live there full time? Is he moving his practice to the Keys?"
"I'll be here. He'll come down weekends."
Deb shrugged.
"Summers, we'll travel."
And this, Yancey thought, is how cruel stereotypes come to be. For concealment, he'd immersed her diamond ring in a bowl of fish dip. It was smoked king mackerel, Yancey being addicted to the stuff. "Follow me," he said, and headed for the kitchen. The bride-to-be was standing at his side as he opened the refrigerator door. Before he could reach for the mackerel dip, she grabbed his arm and said,
"What is that?"
"Oh, human hair." He held up one of the clear baggies.
"But why?" Deb asked, backing up.
"Don't you worry, it's not mine."
"I mean, Jesus, where did... I mean, who..."
"Donor unknown," Yancey said. Out she ran, leaving the front door ajar. Her mode of departure was a loud red Porsche. Yancey sat on the front stoop, thinking he might as well hang on to the diamond for a while. He opened his laptop to check the tides. The sky was bright. The breeze was getting warmer. He felt like going fishing. Mary Mansfield held the phone to Lane Coolman's ear because his hands were bound.
"Amp, it's me," he said. "Where the fuck are you?"
John David Ampergroat liked to be called Amp. He was the chairman/director of Platinum Artists Management, the talent agency that employed Lane Coolman.
"Dude, I've been kidnapped."
"Oh, that's original."
"I'm dead serious," Coolman said. "They snatched me in Key West, broad daylight."
"Snatched as in taken?"
"Totally."
"Jesus Christ, what about Buck? Did they hurt him? How much money do they want?"
"They don't have Buck, just me."
Amp sighed irritably.
"Then where the fuck is Buck?"
"They're asking for 500 grand, cash," said Coolman. "All 50s and 20s.
"This is a joke, right? You're pranking my ass."
"Amp, they're gonna kill me deader than the last Nick Cage movie they don't get paid by sunset tomorrow. Understand? 500 grand in a gray Balenciaga... hang on a sec."
"The new ostrich one,"
Mary clarified.
"You heard that, right? The ostrich Balenciaga," Coolman relayed to Amp. "They said to leave it on the third to the last car of the 5 p.m. conch train, some corny tourist trolley."
"Lane!"
"What?"
"One more time. Where the fuck is Buck Nance?"
"I don't have a clue. I've been tied up, literally."
"You weren't with him?"
"No, I got taken hostage," Coolman said. "I thought I mentioned that.
FYI, the gig was a motherfucking disaster. Buck got chased out of the bar," Amp said. "It's all over social media."
"Well, I can't go searching for him right this minute because, see, there's a loaded gun aimed at my head."
"That's just great.
Can you get working on the ransom ASAP?"
"We'll talk later."
Amp clicked off. Coolman stared at the phone.
"Doesn't sound too promising," Mary said.
Zito shrugged.
"He's a douche, just like Marky Mark said. Nobody gives a shit if he gets whacked. Let's go to the boat."
The Tesla had no trunk, so Coolman was permitted to ride in the back seat. This slender bit of good fortune allowed him to press his case for mercy. Zito remained cold to his pleas, but Mary seemed open to the idea of giving Coolman more time to raise some funds.
"Say nobody comes through. How much you got in the bank?"
she said.
"It's all frozen. I'm in the middle of a divorce."
"Because you cheated on her, right?" He said, "Listen, the agency will definitely pay the $500. I mean, guaranteed. Amp's got a lot on his plate right now, but once he focuses, it's a done deal."
Zito over his shoulder. "No, asswipe, you are the done deal."
At the dock, they hustled Kuhlman aboard an old lobster boat. Zito ordered Mary to go back and wait in the Tesla while he took Kuhlman out to sea. Mary said she wanted to ride along and lingered in the wheelhouse until Zito ran her off. What saved Kuhlman from ending up as shark bait was a damaged wire that made it impossible to start the boat's engine. Zito failed to diagnose the problem and in any case possessed minimal skills with a toolbox. After half an hour, he gave up in a funk that had been aggravated by Mary repeatedly winking the high beams of the Tesla to pester him. Zito shoved Kuhlman into the forward cabin of the boat, taped his mouth, re-cinched the ropes, and left him there. The cramped space reeked of sweat, black mold, and decomposed shellfish, though Kuhlman wouldn't have slept a wink on rose-scented linens at a Four Seasons. He remained shaken by his phone conversation with Amp, who either hadn't grasped the gravity of Kuhlman's situation or had decided he was dispensable. That the agency's most promising curator of talent had been kidnapped by murderous lowlifes should have upset Amp more than the fact that some redneck chicken plucker had disappeared on a bender. For the moment, Buck Nance was a mega client, but Lane Kuhlman was the shining future of platinum artists. Amp himself had said so many times. As he lay in the rank darkness, contemplating the prospect of a watery death, Kuhlman found his thoughts inchworming toward Rachel, his future ex-wife. The cause of their pending disunion was, as Mary Mansfield had surmised, his own uncountable infidelities. These had sparked a series of retaliatory flings by Rachel. If she'd been doing only the Comcast guy, the marriage might have been saved. However, it was her vindictive nature to arrange indiscreet sex with Lane's rival agents from CAA or ICM, and always at the Beverly Wilshire. Worse, she delighted in paying for the suite with his credit card. He recalled his outrage after one such tryst when the hotel billed him for a room service delivery that included 5 cans of Ready Whip, a single maraschino cherry, and a quad pack of D batteries. Rachel was the undisputed queen of the revenge fuck in a town with many contenders for the title. Another memorable hosing, Kuhlman had foolishly taken a latish Friday lunch with one of his hot girlfriends at the Ivy, where he was spotted by a junior turd fondler from William Morris Endeavor named Kane Drucker. Before Kuhlman had even touched his calamari app, Drucker was on the phone with Rachel. The two of them lay in a sweaty tangle by the time Kuhlman and his girlfriend had finished their huckleberry sorbets. And now Rachel's attorneys were doing to Lane in divorce court what she'd done to Drucker and all the others at the Wilshire. The judge had granted Kuhlman a living allowance, pitiable by Hollywood standards, while Rachel's hawk-eyed forensic accountant pored through his bank records and brokerage statements. Such was the desolate state of Kuhlman's liquidity that, by his own calculations, he had at most $21,300 to contribute to his own ransom. "Let me call Amp again," he begged Mary the next morning after she peeled off the duct tape. "You lucked out for now, Bob. The mechanic's too stoned to fix the boat." She didn't tell him that she was the one who'd mangled the ignition wire, foiling Zito's plan to kill him at sea. "Where's your psycho partner?" Kuhlman asked.
"Finding me a crash car. We've got a job this morning."
Mary was wearing a denim jacket and a long cotton skirt with an imitation Seminole bead pattern. Her hair was in a saucy ponytail. To Kuhlman, who'd spent the night huffing lobster fumes, she smelled heavenly. She'd brought him a banana smoothie, put the straw to his lips.
"Suck," she commanded. After downing the whole cup, he told Mary he had to relieve himself.
Do you see a restroom, Bob? This is not a fucking carnival cruise. Cut me a break, okay? I've been holding it all night. Make it fast.
She stood him up, unzipped his pants, and aimed his cock at a random bucket left by the lobster crew.
And if you get hard, she warned, I'll push you overboard myself.
Kuhlman was too unnerved by the grab to become aroused.
I used to be a nurse, said Mary.
No, you didn't.
Okay, I worked in a nursing home for a summer. Same deal. I had to handle lots of dicks.
Welcome to my world, Kuhlman said. While waiting for his bladder to unseize, he pitched an idea.
Tell Zito I got out of the ropes and overpowered you, he said to Mary. Knocked you down, jumped off the boat, and ran away. What's he going to say? Tell him it's all his fault because his lame knots came loose. Would you pee already? We've got a big day.
You don't want to go to prison for a murder. That would be insane.
Swear to God, you jiggle one drop on me, Bob. I just did my nails.
Her watch said 8 a.m. It was 3 hours earlier in Los Angeles, a bad time for engaging amp.
Is there a Bank of America down here? Kuhlman asked. I've got like 21 grand in a checking account, plus the two in my wallet. Oh, Zito already took that.
21 isn't so terrible, right? It's all yours if you take me to the bank and let me go. Screw Zito. Mary flicked Kuhlman's penis back into his pants and dumped the bucket of piss overboard.
You're losing traction with me, she said.
As expected, Amp didn't answer his phone. When Kuhlman blamed the time zone difference, Mary just shrugged. Zito arrived, untied Kuhlman, and led him to the Tesla. This time he let Mary take the wheel while he sat in the back seat pressing the gun to Kuhlman's ribs.
We're going to Bob's bank, Mary announced.
Zito scowled.
Says who?
God, everything's a power play with you. Take a fucking chill pill. The man's in the middle of a soul-crushing divorce, yet he's generously offered to give us every dime he's got left.
You're shitting me, right? Kuhlman said. Again, he felt like a moron. In the rear view, he saw Mary wink at him.
Damn, I just remembered, she said. The banks don't open for an hour.
Forget it, we ain't got an hour, Zito muttered. Let's go get the car.
Mary wanted to stop at a CVS so she could wash her hands and buy a fresh razor. Zito told her to use the one she had.
The one I cut myself with yesterday? No, thank you.
Kuhlman became conscious of the fact that he was the only occupant of the vehicle who hadn't showered the night before, one drawback of being a hostage. He braced for a low comment about his body odor.
You don't need a new razor, Zito carped at Mary.
Now you're an expert on grooming vaginas. Amazing, she said,
parking at a drugstore on Truman. While she was inside, Kuhlman tried to talk some sense into Zito, who shut him up with a sharp twist of the gun barrel. Up close, Kuhlman noticed that Zito had a thin, pinkish scar circling his neck. He decided not to ask about it. The new crash car was an 05 four-door Honda Civic that Zito had bought for $900 cash and stashed behind a Wendy's. Mary gave the Civic a round-the-block spin and pronounced it a death trap.
Like you got a choice, Zito said.
The brakes are totally fried, dude.
Trabeau's staying at the Reach. I sent a chick to his room. She's going to make sure he's outbound on Roosevelt at noon sharp.
Mary said,
Man, I swear.
Past the stoplight at Kennedy. That's where you hit him. This time, no cops. Just stall him for a minute till I get there.
Dazzle him, you mean?
Zito said,
Don't fuck it up again.
They went to scout the intersection, the Tesla following the Honda. Mary pulled off at a strip mall, and Zito turned in beside her, steering with his gun hand free. She got out and walked up to his window.
"I see no problems. This'll be short and sweet," she said.
15 minutes, he'll be coming by with a girl. Meanwhile, this sorry fucker, referring to Kuhlman, is stinking up my interior.
Then let him ride with me.
For the bump?
Zito snickered.
Why not? Mary said. The kiddie-proof locks on that junker still work.
Kuhlman spoke up.
Seriously, guys? I don't want to be involved in this.
Go, Zito said. Make one wrong move, say one wrong word. I'll shoot your phony California ass. Just sit still with your mouth shut and let the lady do the talking.
Mary practically skipped around the car to open Kuhlman's door, saying,
Come on, Bob, it'll be something different.
Sheriff Sonny Summers had never watched Bayou Brethren, but he knew who Buck Nance was, and of course he'd already heard about the incident at the Parched Pirate. Now, some fast-talking shaker named John David Ampergroat was on the phone explaining that his company, make that his agency, represented Mr. Nance.
We haven't heard from him, and frankly, we're concerned for his safety, Ampergroat said.
The sheriff said the protocol on missing persons required at least 24 hours without contact before a report could be filed.
The last thing we want is a missing persons report, okay? Not happening. Nothing in writing.
But that's the only way we can start looking for him, after somebody makes a report.
Oh, come on, Sheriff.
Has it been 24 hours?
No, but Mr. Nance isn't just some homeless tweaker. We're talking about the most popular television personality in the whole damn country. And he's disappeared in your little tourist town. Is that really the kind of publicity you want?
Sonny Summers wasn't the sharpest tack on the corkboard, but he recognized a condescending asshole when he heard one. Still, John David What's-His-Face had a point. If Buck Nance came to a sordid end in Key West, the headlines might adversely affect the city's latest multi-million-dollar advertising push to attract the elusive non-drunk segment of the tourist trade, specifically couples with children. The island was aggressively marketing itself as a safe and carefree family destination, and Sonny Summers well understood his role as a steward of that myth.
Maybe Mr. Nance is just partying with some young lady he met, the sheriff said. It's been known to happen down here. He's happily married for 29 years, exclaimed John David Shithead. Don't you follow the show? He's a lay minister at his church, for fuck's sake.
Sonny Summers said he didn't watch Bayou Brethren because it aired the same night he coached Little League, which was untrue.
I'll FedEx you a box set of the first season, declared Mr. Nance's obnoxious representative. In the meantime, on behalf of the family, I'd like you to green light a major manhunt. Discreetly, of course.
That would basically be impossible in a town this small. Everybody'll know about it in 5 minutes.
Nothing's impossible, Sheriff. When are you up for re-election?
This year.
And I don't suppose you could use a $50,000 campaign donation, no strings attached.
Unlike some office holders in South Florida, Sonny Summers owned a healthy fear of criminal indictment.
The limit on individual contributions is $1,000,
he informed John David Douchebag.
You don't think I've got 50 friends in Hollywood who can write a check that big? Make it 51, including me. Do the math.
Sonny Summers did the math on his pocket calculator. 51 grand worked out to roughly $1.33 for every registered voter from Duval Street to Key Largo. It was enough money to buy truckloads of Keep Sonny yard signs and bumper stickers, money he'd no longer have to pry from local merchants, who, in return, often demanded favors, such as free passes on future DUIs.
Except for the political demands of the job, Sonny Summers enjoyed being the sheriff of the Keys. He didn't mind occasionally wearing a blazer or shaking hands at the Elks Lodge or flying off to law enforcement conventions in Vegas. Physically, he was far more active now than he'd been as a deputy, and as a bonus, the pernicious hemorrhoids he'd acquired during all those nights on road patrol were finally deflating. Even at the height of the season, not much happened on the long chain of islands that required Sonny Summers' undivided attention. He could count on one hand the number of press conferences he'd had. That was because serious crimes in Monroe County were usually overshadowed in the news cycle by some ghastly carnage up in Miami. Colorful, hard-charging sheriffs historically end up squirming in front of grand juries, so civic leaders appreciated Sonny Summers' low profile, aversion to bold ideas, and instinct for ducking controversies. At his wife's urging, he'd once explored the notion of running for state attorney general, only to discover that a law degree was required. Sonny Summers was privately relieved by this deficiency on his resume. He would have been content to remain sheriff forever. Unfortunately, getting reelected was expensive.
"Send the check to my campaign committee," he said to John David Dick Brain. "My assistant will give you the address."
"And you'll get your best people out looking for Mr. Nance?"
"Right away."
Sonny Summers felt sure the missing man would turn up soon in a stewed daze, as other wayward celebrities did, shambling with a venereal sting down Duval Street. His handlers would spirit him away, and that would be the end of his raunchy misadventure in Key West. It was purely wishful thinking by the sheriff. Chapter 4.
"You seem a little nervous, Bob."
"No shit," said Coolman. "It's my second car crash in 2 days.
"Rule number one, relax your body."
Mary Mansfield elevated her skirt as she settled behind the steering wheel.
"Stay as limp as possible. That's why so many drunk drivers walk away from bad wrecks. They're like rag dolls. Tensing up is what causes your major neck and spine issues. Also, keep your seatbelt snug."
In one hand, she held a travel can of Edge gel with aloe. Poised in the other hand was the new Gillette disposable that she'd bought at the drugstore.
"I don't really need to shave again," she said, "but it's gotta look legit for Monsieur Trabeau."
"This is nuts,"
Coolman grumbled from the rear seat.
"Well, does it work or not? I would have given you a ride anyway, without the free peek."
"Maybe so," Mary said. "But that's what iced the deal, and don't pretend otherwise."
She had locked the rear doors with a switch that disabled the interior handles, meaning Coolman was trapped. He could have reached around Mary's headrest and seized her by the neck, but he feared she would lay open his wrists with a razor. He also knew Zito was somewhere nearby watching from the Tesla. Mary said,
"Now cover your eyes while I do this."
"Really? You're about to flash a perfect stranger."
"That's business, Bob. You and I are practically dating."
He saw her tilt the shaving gel can and heard a squirt. He turned away, trying not to think about the skimming sound of the blade.
She said, "Keep your eyes peeled for that silver Buick."
"Can I say something? The whole Mark Wahlberg thing, it was an honest disagreement. Also, we weren't a good fit. Sometimes that happens in my business."
"So you're not really a douche?"
"Not with clients."
This was true. Coolman was loyal and fair relative to the Hollywood norm.
"Mark got an offer to do a voiceover commercial, and yeah, I talked him out of it. The money was insane, but the material wasn't right for him. Trust me."
"Who cares? It's just TV."
"See, no, you're wrong. A megastar like Mark,
Everybody would recognize his voice, and then word gets all over town he'll do anything for a buck. The product, get this, was a combination deodorant and testosterone wipe for men only. Duh. Some greasy goop you smear in your armpits. I told Mark it would hurt his brand, and see, branding is what we do best at Platinum Artists. So he turned down the voiceover gig, and then that slut Affleck said yes for $2 mil. Ben, not Casey. A week later, Mark fires me. But then it turns out I was right. That stuff's got some freaky-ass side effects and major, major PR challenges. But instead of thanking me, Mark, the ingrate, he's still pissed.
It doesn't work? Mary asked.
What?
The jelly. It doesn't give you a titanium hard-on?
You're missing the point, Kuhlman said. The only reason for the story... I wanted to explain why he and I parted ways. It was a professional difference of opinion, that's all.
The armpit thing makes no sense to me. I mean, why not just smear the stuff right on your knob?
Okay, forget I mentioned it. Mary capped the can of Edge and placed it in a cup holder.
Hey, there's our merry traveler.
Where?
Remember what I told you, Bob. Go limp.
Kuhlman grabbed the edge of the seat with both hands as the Civic snaked into the traffic on Roosevelt. Mary weaved between two cars and a city bus, then cut in tightly behind the Buick and goosed the accelerator. The force of the crash jolted Kuhlman, but nothing popped or snapped. He heard Mary swear and saw that the airbag on the steering column had blown open. Snowy powder speckled her cheeks and hair, and she was groping on the floor for the razor, her key prop, which had been knocked from her hand.
That lazy fucking Zito, she said. He's supposed to take out the damn airbags before we do the bump. I've only told him like 100 times.
The deflated fabric obstructed her view, yet Mary managed to hold the Civic on course, trailing the damaged Buick into the same strip mall lot from which Kuhlman had been abducted. A woman wearing Kermit green spandex and 4-inch clogs hopped out of the Target car and beelined for the mall. She never looked back. A man that could only have been Trabeau emerged from the driver's side, stalked up to the Civic, and froze at the sight of Mary Mansfield, pretty much all of Mary, who had dusted off the airbag residue and composed herself. Trabeau's eyes widened, and he swallowed 3 times by Kuhlman's count. With a faint French accent, Mary apologized for the smash-up. Sheepishly, she displayed the razor as she lowered her skirt.
I'm on my way to a really big date.
Trabeau struggled to maintain his outrage.
What the hell were you thinking? I mean, who does that while they're driving? You could kill somebody.
Please, don't call the police. I'll give you cash to fix your car. Can you take me to the Hampton Inn? That's where I left my money.
Kuhlman, who considered himself an expert on deception and double talk, marveled at Trabeau's transformation from irate motorist to lustful schemer. Trabeau stooped to peer at Kuhlman in the back seat.
Who's that?
Some hitchhiker, Mary said. He looked so lonely and pitiful, I had to give him a lift.
Well, Jesus, he got quite a show.
No, that's why I made him sit in the back.
How do you know he's not a rapist or a serial killer?
Because I can read men. He's totally armless.
She lowered her voice.
I think he's brain damaged. Ask the simplest question, all he does is grunt.
Kuhlman tried to establish eye contact with Trabeau, but Trabeau had already refocused on the redhead behind the wheel.
She said,
I'm super-duper sorry I scared your girlfriend away.
Hell, she's not my girlfriend. Where's the Hampton?
Just up the road. I'm Mary, by the way, spelled like Merry Christmas.
She put down the Gillette and shook his hand.
I'm Bill, he said. Where are you from?
She laughed.
Nice to meet you, Bill.
I'll give you a ride to the hotel, but first let's stop somewhere for a margarita. Then maybe afterward we can call it even. No police reports, no insurance companies.
Deal, she said.
What about the hot date you're meeting?
No worries. He's used to waiting.
Kuhlman perceived that he'd become invisible, or at least superfluous. It seemed like a good time to make a move. He dove over the front seat toward the passenger door, which failed to yield to his shoulder.
Simmer down, Mary advised him.
Then to Trabeau,
I told you he wasn't right in the head.
Through the windshield, Kuhlman helplessly watched the gliding ghost arrival of the white Tesla. Mary feigned alarm.
Oh, God, it's him!
Who?
Trabeau asked.
The guy I was supposed to meet. How'd he find me here?
Trabeau guessed that the swarthy young man in the bomber jacket was either a Russian gangster or some empty-headed poser from South Beach. When he saw the man's handgun, all he said was, Oh, fuck.
Exactly, Bill.
Mary swung her long legs out of the Civic, smoothing her dress.
Now be smart.
While she and Zito escorted Trabeau to the Tesla, Kuhlman remained muddled and motionless in the crash car. He didn't notice that Mary had remotely rolled down his window until she flung him an over-the-shoulder glance that said, What are you waiting for, numbnuts? He wriggled headfirst out of the Civic and hit the ground running. Every morning, Yancey woke up amazed that Dr. Rosa Campesino still cared about him. On paper, the match wasn't ideal. She was sharp, beautiful, single, sane, and saved at least two or three lives per day in the ER. He was a banished cop consigned to probing the grim, hot kitchens of funky restaurants, bringing home vile stories of insects amuck in the cornbread mix. Rosa's initial attraction to him wasn't entirely baffling, because Yancey was good at making first impressions. He could be funny and semi-charming, though with smart women that carried you only so far. It didn't take them long to unpeel your true personality. Yancey was prone to an acid bluntness that produced poor results career-wise and also on the domestic front. While he wasn't one of those loud-mouthed fools who uttered every thought that entered their heads, his idea of self-editing often fell shy of the societal norm. Rosa said she tolerated his sharp tongue, preoccupied moods, and impulsive detours because there was old-fashioned nobility in his heart, and his social missteps were made with good intentions. Yancey hoped she truly believed that and wasn't just trying to convince herself he was worth the effort. When he returned from fishing, she was waiting at the house, still wearing her hospital scrubs, which drove him wild, as she well knew.
Catch anything?
She called out as he backed the boat trailer into the driveway.
Nada. The water's still too cold.
But it's a gorgeous day, no?
Breathtaking. Yancey said. She was. While he rinsed the skiff and wiped down his fly rods, Rosa fixed Cuban sandwiches and warmed some black beans with rice. He walked inside and caught her eyeing the container of fish dip, which he snatched from her fingers. After spooning out the engagement ring, he told her the story of Deb and Britt, or Brad, or whatever the hell it was, his potential new neighbors.
Please tell me you're not holding on to her diamond, Rosa said, for leverage.
That would be wrong.
So wrong. Also illegal, no?
But the way she described the house they're planning, it's a bona fide atrocity. I'm not kidding, baby. Maybe worse than the last one. An unspooled ex-girlfriend of Yancey's had torched the previous offending structure in a bid to win back Yancey's affections. Rosa's devotion stopped well shy of felonious melodrama. Yancey wiped off the ring and handed it to her.
Her boyfriend told her it cost 200 grand. What do you think, doctor?
I think it's quite large.
Rosa tossed it back. Come on, try it on.
Really? Here's how my delicate fingers spent the afternoon, groping for lead slugs inside the intestines of a 300-pound heroin dealer who'd shorted the wrong customer. So I'll pass on the hand modeling today, if that's okay.
A man can dream, Yancey said. He mushed the ring back into the fish dip.
The dealer survived, by the way. Shot 5 times and he'll be back on the street in time for Easter.
Rosa bowed.
My service to the human race.
See, this is exactly why you should move down here. Our ER isn't so demoralizing.
Promise you'll return the diamond to this Deb person, no matter what kind of architectural monstrosity she and her scuzzy boyfriend want to build next door. You get busted for grand theft, mister. That's pretty much a career killer.
How did I ever live without you?
How can you not have a decent imported beer in this house?
Rogelio Burton stopped by and had a plate of black beans. He'd been Yancey's best friend and calming influence in the detective bureau, and they were still close. That didn't mean Yancey listened to his advice. Rosa changed into a devastating swimsuit and went out on the deck to catch some sun.
The sheriff sent me, Burton said to Yancey. Where's my badge?
Don't start again.
Then you know what? Sonny and I have nothing to talk about.
The problem was election year politics. Although Yancey had single-handedly solved a major murder case, a first for the Roach Patrol, Sonny Summers had postponed reinstating him due to the controversy it might stir.
You watch much TV? Burton asked.
Weather Channel, Mythbusters reruns, that's about it, Yancey said.
They gouge you for the porn on pay-per-view, so I'm boycotting.
There's a reality show called Bayou Brethren. It's about a family of redneck chicken farmers in Louisiana.
Somehow that one slipped past me.
It's actually funnier than it sounds.
Do-it-yourself liposuction would be funnier than chicken farming.
Being a fisherman, you'll like this. They sell the damn rooster feathers for trout flies. The star is a guy named Buck Nance. They call him Captain Cock, because cock roosters is what they raise.
Burton summarized Nance's catastrophic stand-up appearance at the Parched Pirate.
The dumbass told a gay joke? Yancey said incredulously. On Duval Street?
Burton took out his smartphone and showed one of the YouTube videos taken at the bar. Yancey wondered aloud if Mr. Nance had a death wish.
They ran him off, and now he's gone missing, Burton said. That's why Sonny sent me to see you. He heard what happened at Clippy's, all that hair they found in the cobbler.
It was the quinoa.
I want recipes. I'll call Rachel Ray. Just hang with me on this, Andrew. The AWOL reality dude, he's famous for his long beard. We're thinking maybe he chopped it off in a panic so people wouldn't recognize him. That stuff you picked up at the restaurant, Sonny wants it sent to Miami for a DNA test.
Yancey stiffened. The sheriff's got no jurisdiction over health inspections.
It's the height of the season, man. It would be epically shitty PR for the Keys if something bad happened to this moron while he was here. That's Sonny talking. Drop whatever you're doing and go find Buck Nasty, is what he tells me this morning. You think I signed up for this?
Tell Sonny I'll trade him a hair sample for my detective badge.
Listen, he's the one who cut the sweet deal that kept your ass out of jail. And he's the one who got you another job. Or did you forget already?
Burton was getting aggravated.
Swear to God, Andrew, your own worst enemy is you.
It was not Yancey's first exposure to the concept. He said, "You're lucky I sleep with a forensic expert." He removed one of the collection baggies from the refrigerator, walked outside, and presented it to Rosa on the sun deck. She looked up from the chaise lounge and said,
"For me? This is more romantic than roses."
"Please,
We need to know if it's beard hair.
If you weren't so earnest, I'd pop you in the balls.
From the doorway, Burton said,
Rosa, I swear this wasn't my idea.
She opened the bag and gingerly lifted a salt and pepper tuft.
I would say it's from a white male, middle-aged. My guess is facial, but you'll need to put it under a microscope to make certain. Beard hairs are grooved, and they look triangular in cross-section. By the way, I don't want to hear the story behind this disgusting little treasure. I'm serious.
Rosa had been a rising star with the Miami-Dade Medical Examiner's Office until she burned out on autopsies and quit to go work on live patients. She returned the mystery follicles to the bag and said,
Do you have some Purell, Andrew? You've got exactly 30 seconds.
He sprinted for the medicine cabinet in the bathroom, handing the baggie to Burton as he flew past. Buck Nance's mistress wasn't part of the TV show. He'd been faithfully married to the same woman for almost 30 years, is what America had been told. Crystal Nance was hefty and hard-spoken and loved Buck truly, but she didn't put up with any BS from him or any of the brothers. It had all been laid out in the script for the pilot. Crystal Nance was tough as nails. Buck's girlfriend went by the porny name of Miracle, though she had a master's in computer science from Florida State. Buck had met her at a popular Pensacola oyster bar, where she worked as a second-string shucker. A month later, he bought her a condominium overlooking Escambia Bay, a transaction opposed by John David Ampergroat, Lane Kuhlman, and the entire management team at Platinum Artists. However, they stood powerless against Miracle's allure, which was exclusively sexual. Her favorite position was called the Wet Wolverine, which played deviously to Buck's Wisconsin roots. One night, he shredded an ACL attempting to carry her, mid-coitus, from the ironing board in the condo's pantry to the futon in the living room. The injury, portrayed to Crystal as a post-hole-digging accident, forced a hasty rewrite of a Brethren segment that had called for Buck to kick in the door of Cleroy's brand-new Durango. Miracle was needy and also short of patience. She reacted melodramatically when feeling ignored by Buck, and her tantrums were a source of peptic anxiety for his handlers. With trepidation, John David Ampergroat had phoned her to ask if she'd heard from Buck in Key West.
Not for 37 hours,
Miracle replied with homicidal chill. Amp told her what happened at the Parched Pirate and encouraged her for verification to check out the YouTube clips.
We're all a bit concerned for the big guy, he added, hoping to dilute her anger with worry.
Why? He's just off chasing pussy.
No, he's not. He probably got scared shitless by the crowd, and now he's hiding in a dive somewhere.
Deep in strange pussy. Is where he's hiding, she said.
Miracle, listen to me. Nobody's heard a word from him. Not his brothers, not his mom, not Crystal, nobody.
That's because he and Lane are too busy whore-hopping.
No, no, Buck would never...
Hey, he whore-hopped me, didn't he?
The line went silent. 20 minutes later, somebody hacked the official Bayou Brethren Facebook page and posted a close-up photo of Osama bin Laden side-by-side with a headshot of Buck. The caption said, Two epic beards. Yo, maybe I should join the Taliban. By lunchtime, the bin Laden item had galvanized a horde of patriotic bloggers who didn't know the difference between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, but were nonetheless infuriated by Buck's apparent flippancy. One even accused him of sculpting his facial hair in homage to the dead terrorist. Informed of the crisis, John David Ampergroat became so engrossed in damage control that he was answering his private lines without checking the caller ID, which is how he ended up speaking to an unrecognized number in the 305 area code. It turned out to be a rare payphone in Key West, with Lane Coolman on the line.
"Amp, I escaped!" he shouted. "I got away from those crazy fuckers!"
"Got away from who?"
"You're kidding, right?"
"Oh, shit, yeah, I almost forgot. Sorry, dude, it's been manic around here today. You won't believe what..."
"You forgot I was kidnapped?" said Coolman.
"No, I mean, of course not. It was at the top of my to-do list. The ransom, etc. We were putting together a totally solid counteroffer. But then, dude, Miracle pulled one of her bipolar freakouts.
Unbelievable."
"Yeah, she's a major thundercunt."
"I'm not talking about her, Amp."
"Point is, you got away from the shitheads who snatched you, which, nice work, 007. You saved the agency some serious bank. Plus, you're okay, which is the most important thing."
Well, not really the most important thing, but John David Ampergroat perceived that Lane Coolman needed to feel some love.
"I'm just totally stoked to hear your voice," he said. "Tell me everything that happened, blow by blow, but not right now. The Brethren Facebook page is basically in flames, thanks to Buck's bimbo."
"Yeah, well, I spent my morning as a fucking crash test dummy," Coolman said. "Now I'm standing in a phone booth that doubles as a public urinal. No cash, no credit cards, just the stinking shirt on my back. Get me on a plane back to L.A., okay?"
"Absolutely, buddy. Soon as Buck turns up, we'll send the G5.
"No, I want out of here now."
A message from Amp's assistant flashed on his desktop. A reporter from Al Jazeera was on line 2, seeking reaction to a Taliban statement condemning Buck Nance for mocking Islamic custom.
Motherfuckers. "Lane, I gotta grab this call. We'll book you a suite at the best hotel on the island. Have a shot of tequila, take a hot shower. I'll send money and plastic."
"Seriously, Amp, bring me home."
"I am serious. Buck's your ticket."
Chapter 5. The next morning, they ate breakfast at a diner on Sugarloaf where Rosa broke the news. She was going to Europe for a couple of weeks, Stockholm, Dusseldorf, and Oslo.
"Why Oslo?" Yancey asked.
"The rainforest, of course."
"Be serious, it's freezing cold there."
"Winter, yes," said Rosa, "but at least nobody's getting shot."
"Is that even true?"
"They've got actual laws against walking around with loaded guns on the street. Same in Sweden and Germany."
The proprietor of the diner approached to ask if their meals were all right. Yancey had once written him up for an Eggs Benedict infraction, under-refrigerated hollandaise sauce, but overall he felt he'd been treated fairly. Yancey told him the food was excellent, and the man happily headed back to the kitchen. To Rosa, Yancey said,
"Sometimes I'm dead slow on the uptake. Are you inviting me to come along on your trip?" "I need a break from all the blood, Andrew."
He'd traveled a few times to the Bahamas and once long ago to Canada on a walleye expedition with his father, but he'd never been overseas. He asked Rosa when she was leaving.
"Tomorrow."
"Oh, come on.
The travel agent got me a great package. I know it's last minute. I'm sorry."
"But my passport, it's expired, remember?"
"Still?"
She didn't look up from her omelet. It was impossible to get a passport renewed in 24 hours. The other obstacle was Yancey's job. During the high season, Tommy Lombardo never let Roach Patrol inspectors take vacations, only funeral leaves. "The hospital's cool with your leaving on such short notice?"
"Not at all," Rosa said. "I resigned yesterday."
Boom! "Okay.
Andrew, could you please pass the Tabasco?"
Later, at his house, they made love, though the moves seemed mechanical. Yancey had no intuition about the fragile arc of relationships, so he was accustomed to being blindsided. Still, it always hurt. He was fairly sure that Rosa was dumping him, whether she was aware of it or not. Obviously, she'd planned her trip knowing he couldn't accompany her. His lapsed passport was the reason they'd canceled a dive outing to Eleuthera a few weeks earlier. She said, "I'd better go home and start packing." "When you get back from Europe, you should move down here and open a practice. There's a critical shortage of sultry, multi-orgasmic doctors."
"I bet."
"This sucks," Yancey said as he walked her to the car.
"It's got absolutely nothing to do with you."
"Gosh, I've never heard that one."
"Be good,"
she said, and kissed him. After watching her drive away, Yancey went inside and poured a tall glass of Haitian rum. While searching for limes in the refrigerator, he encountered the fish dip concealing the diamond belonging to Naughty Deb. Soon the dip would go bad and he'd have to find a clever new hiding place. Another option was to quietly give it up. Pretend he'd never seen the damn ring, just toss it over the fence. Eventually, Deb or one of the construction workers would find it on the scorched lot. From his backyard deck, Yancey observed activity on the property, two men conferring as they walked the property lines. The older of them wore a trucker's cap, jeans, and work boots, and he carried a set of cardboard tubes. A builder, Yancey concluded glumly. The other man appeared to be in his early 40s, like Yancey. He wore tailored camel slacks and a shiny shirt, undone perhaps one too many buttonholes. His face was supernaturally tan, his blowfly sunglasses were ultramarine, and his hair glistened like barbecue. Yancey made the shallow but accurate assumption that this person was the Miami lawyer to whom Deb was engaged. Liberated by the rum, Yancey hurried inside, and from the recycled bin in the pantry, he pulled three empty bottles of Stella, the import he'd bought for Rosa. Then he snatched his 12-gauge and hurried back to the deck. The first toss was too low, and his shot missed the bottle. On the second toss, which was perfect, he blew the neck off. The third beer bottle he blasted into granular rain that harmlessly peppered his skiff parked in the driveway. By now, on the other side of the fence, Brock and his builder were retreating toward their respective vehicles, a Ford pickup for the builder, a sports car for the lawyer. Yancey waved amiably at the men but failed to elicit a response. They sped off without even tooting their horns. Yancey picked up the shotgun shells and every piece of broken glass, a time-consuming chore. After refreshing his drink, he stretched out on the sofa, opened his laptop, and committed himself to three back-to-back episodes of Bayou Brethren. He wasn't too drunk to comprehend the show's appeal, and found himself wondering about the secret to Buck and Crystal's long marriage. She plainly wasn't enchanted by life on the rooster farm, barely tolerated the other brothers, and complained constantly about Buck's aversion to slow dancing, seatbelts, and Hank Williams. Nonetheless, she remained devoted to her man, which touched Yancey in his maudlin swoon. He pressed the pause button, freezing a close-up as Buck challenged Crystal on the subject of free-range chicken facilities, which Buck proclaimed were exorbitant and also underappreciated by the chickens. Yancey took out one of the evidence bags to compare the silver-gray wads plucked from Clippy's quinoa to Buck's long, lushly tended beard. Holding the baggie next to the laptop screen, Yancey decided the shorn hair was identical in coloration. It wasn't as definitive as the DNA test in progress, but why wait? Rosa was flying away to Europe, and he needed a distraction. Tomorrow, he would go searching for Captain Cock. Matthew Morgan Romberg and his brothers were born in Milwaukee and raised in the suburb of Whitefish Bay. They were not authentic shit-kickers, although Wisconsin has its share. Their father was a successful commodities trader, and their mother bred prize English setters, which she sold to wealthy bird hunters. The Romberg household was politically divided to the extreme, Kathleen Romberg being a Hubert Humphrey Democrat, while her husband parroted the views of Alabama's incendiary governor, George Corley Wallace. The tension was too much for the marriage, and one day Mrs. Romberg ran off with a snowmobile mechanic who reminded her of Cat Stevens. The Romberg boys fell under the strident sway of their father, although they grew up displaying little of his vehemence and none of his business savvy. Matthew, who would one day become Buck Nance, attended the University of Minnesota and dropped out 6 credits shy of a finance degree. Bradley, Jr., Henry, Buddy, and Todd, Cleroy, all went to Madison, joined the same Greek fraternity, and entered the music program, which impressed a certain dreamy type of co-ed, but somewhat narrowed their prospects for secure employment. One by one, they returned to their father's house in Whitefish Bay and reoccupied their childhood bedrooms. While mulling options, the younger brothers started a band that performed accordion covers of popular rock songs. Matthew joined up after being fired, under cloudy circumstances, from a hard-won management position at Florsheim Shoes. He blamed reverse racial discrimination, when in fact the company had caught him stealing Cordovan wingtips by the gross and hawking them at a flea market near Eau Claire. It was there he'd connected with Crystal Nordvall, his future spouse, who presided over a booth offering hand-blown bongs and bootleg 8-tracks. The name of the brothers' accordion band was GFR, which stood for Grand Funk Romberg, and they kept it rolling even as they grew older, married, and settled into undemanding day jobs. Mostly, they played weekends at county fairs and chili cook-offs, but every once in a while, they scored a wedding. The idea to grow out their beards came one summer night from Matthew while they were rehearsing a raucous, polka-fied rendition of Tube Snake Boogie. He suggested that they work up a 4-song medley of ZZ Top hits, which soon became the centerpiece of their act. Todd taught himself the bass guitar, and Henry bought a drum kit at a pawn shop in Green Bay. At first, their beards grew unevenly, so the Rombergs wore fakes, borrowed from a local theater troupe that specialized in nativity plays. The beards, used by Joseph and 2 of the wise men, had to be returned in time for Christmas rehearsals. By then, the brothers' natural facial bloom was in full glory. Out of nowhere, GFR received an offer to play a rodeo down in Little Rock, Arkansas. Matthew saw this as a portal to stardom, and after researching the demographics, he proposed that the group change its name to Buck Nance and the Brawlers. The other brothers had no objections because Matthew deserved top billing, serving the triple threat roles of lead accordion, promoter, and business manager. The Rombergs were eager to gain a following in the South, as they'd become increasingly disenchanted with the so-called progressive elements on the rise in Wisconsin politics. They looked forward to reaching a wholesome, simple-minded audience that would appreciate their anti-government patter between songs. Also, they'd never been to a real rodeo. Buck Nance and the Brawlers performed 8 songs and were well received, their barbed commentary drawing laughs and even some applause. After the gig, Bradley dislocated a shoulder when one of the cowboys let him throw a rope on a calf, but the other brothers bought him a sling at Walgreens and dosed him with painkillers. 2 nights later, they opened at a shrimp festival in Biloxi, and 2 nights after that, they were playing a Masonic lodge near Stone Mountain, Georgia. Matthew's bold prediction was coming true. The band caught fire on the biker and Bible circuit. The Rombergs traded their Dodge minivan for a second-hand Winnebago and said goodbye to Whitefish Bay. During the next 20 years, they returned only once to attend the funeral of their father. The old man had suffered a massive heart attack during an ice storm while covertly trying to scrape an Obama for President bumper sticker from a smug neighbor's Audi. The election of a black president brought a boom in TV reality shows featuring feisty rednecks, and talent scouts began scouring the Dixie Belt in a fevered search for the next Duck Dynasty franchise. Buck Nance and the Brawlers were discovered at a Howard Johnson's off the interstate near Chattanooga, playing a toned-down set for a Catholic bachelorette party. They were flown, business class, to Los Angeles for a meeting at Platinum Artists with John David Ampergroat, who pronounced the Romberg brothers perfect, except for their superior dental work. He promised them fame and wealth, presented a 2-year management contract, and sent them by limousine to a Malibu orthodontist to get their front teeth darkened and chipped. Matthew was allowed to keep the stage name of Buck, while his brothers chose their own from a list of homespun monikers provided by the agency. The transition from obscure regional musicians to wildly popular television stars put a strain on the brothers' fraternal bond. From the beginning, the creators of Bayou Brethren felt the show should revolve around the colorful Buck character and the iron-willed Crystal. Inevitably, resentment took root among the other family members. Junior, Buddy, and Cleroy also had wives who enjoyed being recognized in the supermarket, and they wanted their own storylines. Tension between the younger brothers and Buck began to worsen during the tapings, a situation which elated the director, a pragmatic Brit named Damien Poe. Soon, he began placing fungo bats at strategic locations throughout the Nance compound in hopes that one of the siblings would snap while the cameras were rolling. Buck's dalliance with sex-crazed Miracle exacerbated his brother's jealousy while making their lives more wretched at home. Among